Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
G'day, g'day listeners. The scent emanating from your wireless is that of garlic. I'm up at the farm doing Tolstoyan toil, helping pull the garlic crop, and I'm sitting here and all alone in the Musselbrook studio to present tonight's program. Later on, we're going to reveal the dirty secrets behind the current free trade negotiations we're having with the United States. These are not being widely covered. In fact, they're behind closed doors. Well, we're going to attempt to push that door open just a little. He's known as one of the greatest minds of our time, the most celebrated scientist, in a popular sense, at least since Einstein. An internationally revered, respected genius whose luminous intelligence shone into the black hole. That was just one of his achievements. Stephen Hawking, cosmologist, theoretical physicist, only last year retired from his position as professor of mathematics at Cambridge Uni, a post he held for 30 years. Pretty impressive for a bloke who wasn't expected to live past his 20s after being diagnosed with motor neuron disease. His book, A Brief History of Time, all but outsold the Bible, 25 million copies worldwide, and I'm confident that 24,999,000 of them remained incomprehensible to the purchaser. But it brought Hawking unprecedented fame and wealth, only exacerbated the complexities of family life, and in particular, the pressure experienced by his wife Jane. The announcement in 1990, as I recall, on their 25th anniversary, that Stephen was leaving his wife for one of his nurses was big news, and as these things often do, it shattered communication between him and Jane and their three kids for years. Now, Jane went on to marry an old family friend, Jonathan Hallier-Jones, but she felt compelled to write an account of a 25-year marriage. I imagine it was necessarily for therapeutic reasons as much as anything. Her latest book, Travelling to Infinity, My Life with Stephen, is actually an updated memoir. Now, that's very unusual, isn't it? To reflect the healing of the rift with her former husband. And I'm delighted to say that she joins me tonight from the BBC studio in Cambridge. Jane, what's the BBC studio in Cambridge look like? Is it different from other radio studios? Does it have, you know, oak panelling?
Oh, well, you ask that question, Philip, but it just looks like I'm sitting in a little concrete box, I think. White walls, grey panels on the walls. It's a new building, and I have great difficulty finding it this morning. I left home ages ago and then got stuck in a traffic jam just outside the door, and I was terribly afraid I wasn't going to be here to talk to you, but here I am.
Well, I'm doubly grateful that you've made it through all those those vicissitudes. Why did you want to rewrite your memoir?
There were various reasons. One was that I was actually invited to do so. The first version was published by Macmillan, and it was called Music to Move the Stars, which I hoped would combine our interests, my interest in music and Stephen's interest in astronomy. And it was really badly slated by the critics. They were so indignant that a mere wife, a mere carer, could actually manage to write an autobiography, a memoir about her life, her privileged life, with the world's greatest scientist. And they tore it to pieces. Well, they didn't even bother to read it. They just tore it to pieces without bothering to read it. So when an opportunity came up to revise it with a small publishing house called Alma Books, I jumped at the opportunity, actually, because the first version, anyhow, was written in a flush of grief, extreme grief, and I just wanted to give a more measured account, possibly a more measured account, of how our lives were. And so in 2007, Travelling to Infinity, My Life with Stephen, came out, and it's just come out in paperback. You might ask, and I expect you will, why did I write a memoir at all? Well, it was a long time before I could reconcile myself to writing the record of my life with a famous, perhaps as you said yourself, the most famous scientist alive today. And Stephen, of course, is not just a scientist. He's suffering from this horrible disease called motor neurone disease, and he is a genius. So there were a lot of elements there.
But then, one of the things that sort of affronted people was that, as you say, you dared to describe the international icon as arrogant, imperious, egocentrist. But and I have to say that even with the compassion of the rewrite, he still comes across as pretty hard to handle.
He is totally immersed in physics. And that's a wonderful thing for him, because physics is his escape from the physical world, and he can travel through billions of miles in space-time. But it does mean that he's not really rooted in the physical world that I had to cope with. And he had very little understanding, I think, of what was involved in looking after him, looking after a home, or creating a home, creating a family and looking after all of them.
Jane, do you know whether he read your first book?
I don't know, and it's a question that I love to ask him, and I do see him quite often. I saw him on Monday of this week, but there's never time, Philip, because he is so preoccupied, A, as I've said, with physics, and B, with his day-to-day survival, that he doesn't really have time for conversations outside physics and conversations which involve any sort of small talk. I go into his house thinking, I must talk to him, I must ask him if I can read him some of it, if I can try to explain to him why I wrote it, and I wrote it because I realised that my life, through his fame, had become public property. And I needed to commit those experiences to print because I had this huge burden of memories that were weighing me down and stopping me getting on with my own life. And that's all quite apart from the campaigns that I hoped this book would
Jane, it is a rule of this program that I never invade guests' privacy beyond the limits that they set. But I want to raise the issue of sexuality. I've been involved in disability politics for decades, and it's always struck me that the biggest no-no that you can possibly do is raise the issue of sex with and disabled people. You did.
It's so critical, isn't it?
And I think it's a nonsense, and I congratulate you for writing about sex with Stephen, but many felt that you'd gone far too far. Was that sort of censorious reaction a surprise to you?
I thought it was a very hypocritical reaction. It was that, I suppose, actually, if you think back 20 or 30 years, people didn't want to know about disability. People who were disabled were supposed to stay indoors and not be seen out in the streets. And we broke that taboo by going everywhere and insisting on having curbs lowered, staircases made into ramps so that disabled people could go anywhere they wanted, so that disabled people and seating in cinemas and theatres. And I think this is another taboo which needs to be broken. I mean, there's so much sexual license in the world today that I don't understand why there's not some understanding of the difficulties that people who have sexual problems, and that goes for people in relationships where disability is concerned.
I cannot think of a disabled person I know who wouldn't salute you for doing it.
Well, and of course, thank you.
And it is significant because the way your separation was reported, it was Stephen who decided to leave you for the nurse, but you had actually started a relationship with your future husband while you were still married, and Stephen condoned it.
He seemed to understand it. Which I think is the most I can say. And given the difficulties of having a marital relationship with him, I hoped that if he found somebody who was stronger than I was in coping with these situations, that we could settle into some sort of modus vivendi. But it didn't work like that. The person who took him away from us just wanted to erase me from the records and assert herself in very cruel terms.
I'm restricted in talking about the nurse. I remember,
of course, so am I.
Great rage in the stories that came out, but let's put those aside.
Yes,
and
do
let me remind the listener that Stephen was a very good-looking young bloke when you met him. I've got this. I'm looking at the photograph of the two of you.
Yes,
he was quite
nice.
Gorgeous,
he was
wasn't
lovely.
He?
He was lovely, yes, yes. And, of course, he was already suffering from motor neurone disease, but didn't know it at that stage. This goes back a long, long way. We first met on the 1st of January 1963, and it was some weeks after that he was diagnosed, and then he was told by the consultant that nothing could be done with him, so please don't bother to come back.
Is that
and
right?
this is another thing, you see, that I one reason for writing the memoir was that the horrors of this disease should come to the notice of all the professionals, and that no consultant should ever say that ever again to some poor young soul who is being diagnosed with a terminal disease.
You made an extraordinarily courageous decision not to discuss the disease with Stephen.
I found that quite
enigmatic.
Yeah, me too. And I didn't make that decision, Philip. It was that Stephen refused to talk about it. And I found that very, very difficult. He just would brush it aside. And of course, now in modern psychological terms, one regards that as denial. So he was in denial about it. But I needed to know. I needed to know what was going to happen. How were we going to cope? And he would just say, well, I'm doing my best. And of course, he was doing his best. And I couldn't dispute that. Mm. But when I think back that had I known that he was still going to be alive today, 47 years later, I think I wouldn't have let him get away with behaving like that.
You were young socialists when that photograph was taken, and even then, as you say, Stephen had started stumbling and couldn't tie his shoelaces. But there was something else that separated you apart from your states of health, and that was your fundamental philosophies, because you are a deeply religious woman, and of course Stephen's one of my mob.
Oh, are you an agnostic or an atheist?
I'm an atheist, I'm afraid. But
okay.
Don't come between us.
No, I'm not going to let it, of course not. I wouldn't say I was deeply religious, but my mum was a very profound influence on me, and she was religious, and so I was brought up in a Church of England household. My dad wasn't so religious. And my mum virtually said to me when Stephen and I became engaged that you will need your faith to carry you through this one, and she was right. She really was. I just had to go on believing that what I was doing was right, and I had to persevere in the course that I'd set myself. And actually, don't forget, Philip, I don't know whether you remember, but in the 60s, we all lived under a nuclear cloud.
Remember it absolutely
vividly. Well, I don't know.
Vividly.
I thought you might be about 25.
I'm afraid not. I'm 71. Okay. So
well,
I understand that entirely. But was there some way in which you, a young girl from St. Albans studying medieval literature, a young woman of religious persuasion. Is there some way that perhaps that interacted with Stephen's immense religious scepticism to produce an energy?
I suppose you could put it like that. I mean, he respected the fact that I needed my faith, and of course I respected his pursuit of physics. And in a sense, you know, we are looking at the origins of the universe, but from different perspectives. And I don't think nowadays that the divide between physics and religion is it religion in the sense of looking for the origins of creation is as profound as it used to be.
I've had many Templeton Prize winners on the program over the years, all of whom would loudly echo what you're saying.
Yes, but and in fact, I have to say, do you know, that Stephen may be, you know, black holes are not supposed to be as black as they seem to be. I'm not sure that Stephen is as atheistical as he appears to be, because on a recent television program, he was talking about the origins of the universe and saying that there is this conundrum that nobody has been able to resolve. And some people resolve it by resorting to the theory of God as the creator. And all he said, he didn't say that's not the case because physics has all the answers. All he said was that's not necessarily so. So I thought he chose
there's
these words.
There's a wonderful
carefully.
Song in Porgy and Bess called It Ain't Necessarily So.
Yeah.
Now, look, I found it interesting that even when he could talk quite fluently, he hardly ever did. You know, there were long periods where you were, the marriage was almost a silent movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was so involved in himself and so involved in physics. And sometimes, and yet he had this wonderful sense of humour that he always had the last word and could make people laugh. And he had very engaging manner with his wonderful smile. So it was almost as if he didn't need to talk. And of course, the result of that is that it makes it so much easier for him now that he has to talk through a computer because the computer is very, very slow. Mm. But then that's how things always were.
I'm talking to the delightful first wife of Stephen Hawking, Jane, about her revised memoir on their life together. Tell the listener why you came to hate Wagner.
That is a very good one. I was just thinking about that myself. Well, you see, there were days in the early days when Stephen would become totally immersed in himself. And it was almost as if you stood in front of him and you waved and he wouldn't see you. And he had his head on his his elbow on his knee, sitting in a wheelchair, elbow on his knee, head in that hand, just like, I don't know whether your listeners will be familiar, with Rodin's sculpture, Statue of the Thinker. And he would listen to hours and hours and hours of Wagner blaring very loud. Now, Wagner is a wonderful composer, but I find him very, very manipulative. And if you are preparing a meal, doing the washing up, looking after two tiny children, bathing the children, and Wagner is blaring out somewhere else in the house, and you can't actually attend to that at the same time.
The reason I focused on Wagner is because I travel vast distances and used to play a lot of music. And I found that if I was listening to Wagner as I drove, I would accelerate to almost warp speed. And it's a miracle I didn't run into a tree.
So absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's engulfing Wagner's. Yeah. Anyhow, so you can imagine the scenario, tiny children running here and there and all the rest of it. Stephen, just oblivious to the rest of the world, but having Wagner on. And I was so worried that there was something really wrong, that he was in pain, that he was depressed, that he was feeling that he was falling ill. So I would get absolutely frantic, thinking, what on earth is going on here? And get very, very tense and very upset. And then this would happen perhaps over a weekend. It would start, say, on a Thursday or a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then by Sunday evening, he would look up with a beatific smile and tell me, oh, he'd solved the problem in physics. And so this was the other partner in our marriage.
I have to remind the listener, I'm sorry, but we're running out of time and I want to cover more things. One of the things, the marriage got so difficult for you that there was at least one point when you considered suicide. Was this because your spirit was being crushed by his demands?
I felt exhausted. I think it was a physical exhaustion. It was a mental exhaustion, and it was an emotional exhaustion, and I just didn't see how I could carry on. I didn't actually think, oh, I'm going to go down to the river and throw myself in. It was just there, always, as a background consideration, if you like.
Well, your loyalties were sharply divided between looking after the kids and Stephen. He was incredibly ambitious, and he would hector you to travel with him to international conferences. You hate flying, yet you always...
Oh, I don't know. Not
oh,
now.
You've overcome that. That's good.
Oh, I have. I'm coming to Australia, Philip, in 2 months' time.
Well, I hope I can meet you in person when you do.
Oh, that'd be nice.
And we can continue this. But you always ended up deferring to him. Now, this raises the issue. Could he have achieved such success without your extraordinary level of support?
I can't answer that one, can I?
It's a very diplomatic silence.
I just don't know.
Yeah. I have to say that his family didn't treat you very well. That's that appalling comment that your mother-in-law made when the marriage broke. You know,
when I look back now, I think that is the thing that hurts most. I was very, very young when I first met Stephen and when I committed myself to him. And they were just so disparaging all the time.
Well, I'm actually going to read the words that Isabel said to you.
Mm.
We never really liked you, Jane. You do not fit into our family. Now, that is
a
terrible thing to say. How did you find them?
Well, at first, I was sort of beguiled by them because they were interesting, innovative, very intellectual and entertaining. But they didn't have much in the way of what you might call human qualities. And that, of course, when I was a little bit older, was what I valued more than anything in my own family and my own parents.
Mm. Do you think Stephen fears death?
Yes, I think he does. I think he's probably more reconciled to it now that he is older and he knows that it's the fate that's going to come to all of us. So in a sense, now that he's, 68, 69, it's perhaps, he's going to be 69 in January, perhaps it's not quite so difficult for him now.
I'd like to end our brief chat On a slightly happier note,
and that's the
fact that you were there at one of Stephen's eureka moments. Lucy was 3 weeks old. You were feeding her. Stephen was getting ready for bed. In a few words, tell us what happened.
Well, Stephen was sitting on the side of the bed one night. It must have been November 1970, because Lucy was about 3 weeks old, and he was struggling to put his pyjamas on. Well, he had to get on with that himself, because I was sitting on the other side of the bed feeding the baby. And the thing about Stephen is that he has had to concentrate so hard, and this explains a lot, because he was visualizing the geometry of black holes in his head. And so he was very, very slow buttoning up his pyjamas, but then it takes a long time to feed a baby. So when finally I put the baby down and he'd got his pyjamas on, it was another one of those eureka moments, because he had calculated that whatever happens to a black hole, its surface area can never decrease in size. Now, well, on that happy
and optimistic note, we must take our leave of each other. But look, thank you very much. It's been a delight to talk to you. Travelling Towards Infinity, My Life with Stephen by Jane Hawking is published by Elmer Books, and I commend it to you. This is Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and a plethora of other modalities. And I believe that a lot of these programs are being sucked at this very moment into a black hole. Let's play a little bit of music, and then we're going to take you behind the scenes at the Australian-US negotiations on free trade. I think you're going to be quite shocked.